Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Love, A Very Short Introduction by Ronald D'Souza. Narrated by Paul Heitch. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to tables present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Chapter 1. Puzzles. Love is the acute awareness of the impossibility of possession. Arnold Pernes. Love is, in fact, quite ordinary, less than cosmic, not the answer to all of life's problems, and sometimes calamitous. Robert C. Solomon. Some people have been driven mad by love. Some have died for it, and some have killed for love. Not all that often, if truth be told, in real life. But to characters in operas and plays, it happens all the time. Everyone expects it when they see or read about love as tragedy and seems to understand it. It almost might have happened to us. You yourself, dear listener, may have gone a little crazy once or twice and felt the thrill of shared love, or the secretly self-important anguish of love unrequited. Poets, musicians, artists, and philosophers have drawn inspiration from that feeling, and spurred on by love, done their best and worst. They have vied to convey the life-changing intensity of it. And yet, when most of us try to describe it, love sinks lifelessly into banality. Although the vagaries of love often seem incomprehensible, the throng of poets, novelists, philosophers, and songwriters who chatter about love has lately been joined by biologists and brain scientists who promise to explain it all. Will they dispel the mystery? Perhaps they will bring us, at last, the long-sought-after pill or potion that can seal the bond of love, or free us from its spell. Whether that is possible or whether it would be desirable are among the questions raised in this book. Love stories seldom have happy endings. The greatest love stories usually end in death. The lighter ones, known as romantic comedies, end in marriage. But the convention that marriage is a happy ending also hints that marriage is, indeed, an ending, which is a kind of death. Not death of the lovers, or even of their love, but death of the love story. Fortunately, many a marriage bears witness to the fact that both love and story can survive a wedding. But then there's death again, the real kind that comes to part us. In the end, then, all love stories are sad. And yet, what a ride is to be had while it lasts. The bitter sweetness of evanescence makes for deeper joy. In the words of the poet Andrew Marvell, "If we cannot make the sun stand still, yet we will make it run." So what, as the song goes, is this thing called love? I will not be canvassing all our uses of the word love. Any thesaurus will supply some 4 dozen common near synonyms. Each has its own nuance. Some are wide apart from one another. Fondness is not idolatry. Liking is not lust. Partiality may or may not result from passion. Rapture is more rash by far than a soft spot. More arcane Greek words are used to distinguish some importantly different kinds of love. 3 of them imply no sexual desire. Philia evokes close friendship. Storge connotes caring in the sense of taking care of, implying concern for the beloved's interests and welfare, such as we might feel for close friends or family. But storge is not incompatible with sexual desire, unlike agape, sometimes rendered as charity, which is a sort of indiscriminate, universalized, and sexless storge. The virtues of agape are described in one of Paul's epistles to the Corinthians. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. These are qualities one might hope to find in any desirable human relationship, but for that very reason, agape lacks two obvious features of love, as commonly understood. First, love is all about singling out one, or at most, a few persons as irreplaceably special. Those we love play a role in our life that the mass of humanity cannot. Yet, agape asks us to favor all our neighbors to the exclusion of none. Second, the injunction to love one another implies that one could do so at will. But loving, or ceasing to love, is not something we can just decide to do. A fourth Greek word, eros, best picks out the topic of this book. Eros is typically associated with intense sexual attraction. It is eros, not agape or storge or even philia, that has inspired a greater number of poems, music, works of art, and crimes than any other human condition. For eros, in its most extreme, obsessive, anxious, and passionate romantic form, I shall borrow the term limerence, coined by the American psychologist Dorothy Tenoff. Despite the unfamiliarity of that word in ordinary speech, there are good reasons for reserving a special term for what George Bernard Shaw called the most violent, most insane, most delusive, and most transient of passions. For although it is far from being the whole of erotic love, limerence hogs most of love's press. Contrary to what is often assumed, love is not an emotion. To be sure, the thought of love is likely to conjure up delicious and tender feelings. Those loving feelings are indeed emotions, but they are far from being the only emotions that constitute erotic love. Depending on circumstances, depending on where you are, in just what love story, love might be manifested in sorrow, fear, guilt, regret, bitterness, gloom, contempt, humiliation, elation, dejection, anxiety, jealousy, disgust, or murderous rage. Rather, think of love as a condition that shapes and governs thoughts, desires, emotions, and behaviors around the focal person who is the beloved. Like a kind of prism, it affects all sorts of experiences, even ones that don't directly involve the beloved. I will call that a syndrome, not a kind of feeling, but an intricate pattern of potential thoughts, behaviors, and emotions that tend to run together. And if it also evokes a disturbance that might call for medical attention, that connotation is not always inappropriate. A person in love, especially if they are limerent, is often said to be crazy with love. This very short introduction is written from the perspective of a philosopher. Philosophy loves puzzles, and love provides a welter of puzzles. It does not take exceptional humility to admit that we are often confused about it. Love is selfless. Love is selfish. Love is kind. Love is cruel. Love is fickle. Love is forever. Love is heaven. Love is hell. Love is war. Love communes with the divine. Love justifies the worst of crimes. Some say God is love, and surely both have much to answer for. Traffic with the divine can be perilous, even for bystanders. Let us begin, then, with a sampling of puzzles raised by common ideas about love. Objects of love. What can we love? Can just anything figure as someone's love object? So it might seem at first sight. You can love travel, or carrots, or mathematics, or fast cars. But these are more strictly likes than loves. For erotic love, the range of possible objects seems to be more restricted still. Only human beings are eligible, and among those, some people assume, only those of a single gender. For some, that single gender is the opposite sex. For others, it is, well, the opposite of that. These restrictions betray two prejudices. First, that objects of love should be confined to one gender, and second, that there are just two genders. Perhaps neither of these prejudices, dear listener, holds sway with you, but you probably still endorse other taboos. The one, for example, that finds it loathsome for an adult's love to be directed at an adolescent. Even the horror inspired by pedophilia is culturally parochial. At other times and places, man-boy or man-girl love has been deemed normal. In modern democracies, we are no longer shocked by homosexuality, adultery, consensual sadomasochism, or erotic passion unsanctioned by parents or priests. But our disgust at pedophilia has spread to forms of erotic relations with young adults accepted in some cultures with an intensity usually associated with taboos. Only one other taboo comes close in intensity. Zoophilia, the erotic love that some people feel for animals, also inspires horror, especially when it is confused with bestiality, which is just sex with non-human animals. Both are explored with brio by Edward Albee in his play Who is Sylvia, which features a man limerent for a goat. The taboo against sex with animals is frequently defended on the ground that animals cannot consent. It says much about the peculiarity of our attitudes to animals, love, and sex that some people who offer this objection never think of asking a cow or pig for their consent to be killed and eaten. In our enlightened age, it seems, only animals can suffer a fate worse than death. More peculiar still, but subject more to puzzled ridicule than horror, are objectophiles, who claim to be in love with inanimate objects. One world champion in archery had a passionate affair with her bow. When love faded, so did her skill. She went on to marry the Eiffel Tower. In any case, the line between the animate and the inanimate is getting blurred. Japanese robotics is working diligently at replacing simple inflatable sex dolls with gendered robots with increasingly sophisticated conversational and empathic skills. Already, pets, both natural and robotic, have been shown to lower anxiety and blood pressure in the isolated inmates of retirement homes. It is only a matter of time before robots are able to provide intimate emotional and sexual companionship to love-starved humans of all ages. Providing, that is, philosophers and psychologists can discover just what it is that the love-starved humans are actually starved of. In short, while love is often assumed to be a peculiarly human capacity, there seem to be no natural constraints on what people can claim to love. For the truly broad-minded, that includes animals, inanimate objects, and some things in between. Is it a mistake to be thus broad-minded? If you are too open-minded, a wit once quipped, your brain might fall out. Objectophiles undoubtedly feel something, but can it really be love? Well, why not? How can we decide such a question? Almost all of the experts who have written on the subject are keen to tell us how to tell true love from counterfeits. Some forms of love, they assure us, are nobler and higher. Others are base and not quite human. That is a moralizing impulse I shall try to resist. My working assumption is that no form of love is inherently more real than others. Will some forms of love make you happier? Perhaps, but then your conception of love probably contributes to the very understanding of the happiness by which you judge it. In any case, there is always something arbitrary in arguments about definitions. Instead of attempting to define love, then, let us move on to a few more puzzles that are raised by some familiar talk about love. How subjective is love? The difficulty in pinning down the range of objects to which love is appropriate might raise the suspicion that the lover has made it all up. Despite individual differences, most of our judgments are widely shared. When assessing a mathematical proof, all those deemed competent to understand it are expected to agree. In all but the most arcane branches of mathematics, there is no room for saying, "I understand what you're saying, but I disagree." In the case of physical phenomena and their explanation, disagreement and debate are normal, but we expect a scientific consensus to emerge. When such disputes are settled, that confirms our conviction that they refer to objective facts. Even our emotional responses, disgust, admiration, anger, fear, are widely shared. But that does not seem to be true of love. Some people are judged attractive or sexy by millions, so there may be something objective about attractiveness, but attractiveness is not lovability. For many people, erotic love is something that happens only rarely, sometimes not even once in a lifetime. And someone in love does not expect, and might not welcome, the discovery that his beloved was also the object of passionate erotic love for millions of others. Is there something objectively present in the beloved that elicits your love? If there is, it works its magic only on you, and maybe a few more potential rivals, we say. But why not speak instead of fellow aesthetes who share your good taste? Perhaps your choice depends on factors that affect you because of accidents in your own life and nature, such as a resemblance between your lover and some caretaker you were attached to as an infant. That would not prove that your choices are purely subjective, for perhaps by a lucky accident, your early caretaker just happened to be objectively lovable. More likely, however, she just happened to be there for you to latch onto. Every new mother resembles Titania in A Midsummer Night's Dream. After a magical potion was poured in her ear, she is chemically inclined to bond with the infant she sees after giving birth. Whatever the truth of that may be, the extent to which love depends on the properties of the beloved or on the inclinations of the lover defines a range of possibilities from objectivity to subjectivity. On the objectivist side, love might be driven by our innate aspiration to the beautiful and good. At the other end, all that matters is the luck of an initial encounter. Every newborn is like those goslings who faithfully followed the ethologist Conrad Lorenz after he had ensured that his own head, and not their mother, would be the first thing they saw when they hatched. At this end of the spectrum, the qualities of the beloved are irrelevant. An ethologist is as good as a goose. Put in such a stark manner, both extreme alternatives seem absurd. Love relates particular individuals, each of whom is entirely unique. This is no mere trope. The likelihood of two individuals sharing a single genome, unless they are twins or clones, is as remote as the chance of hitting at random on a particular elementary particle among all those in the known universe. If love reflects the unique characteristics of the individuals involved, we should expect a virtually infinite diversity of human loves. What is puzzling is that the exquisite uniqueness of both lover and beloved seems to manifest itself in a surprisingly restricted number of stock scenarios. Do we love for reasons? Though many people curse the sheer absurdity of their own passion, others will insist that they have sound reasons for their love. But when listed, the reasons are liable to be banal or unintelligibly idiosyncratic. The beloved, for their part, may want to be loved for the right reasons, but what are those? One common answer is, for who I am. But when a lover asks, why do you love me? Trying to answer can feel like tiptoeing through a minefield. The reasons Romeo would give for loving Juliet are not necessarily those that Juliet would choose to be loved for. When Romeo rhapsodizes about her resemblance to the sun, she might protest, I may be hot, but I'm not a bit like the sun, really. And when I pour my soul into playing the lute, you hardly even listen. Besides, whatever the reasons for Romeo's love, other women may be found who equal or excel Juliet in just those qualities. Even if he does not leave her for someone who more closely resembles the sun, she will surely change. Her beauty will fade, her hair fall out, her wit dry up, and then, quite reasonably, Romeo may no longer love her. Best, all things considered, to die an early death. The solution of choice for legendary lovers. Is love blind? Let us for now accept that Romeo loves Juliet because she is the sun. It's not much of a reason, really, but if she is, no wonder he is blinded. The blindness of love is a truism. In fact, it is twofold. Romeo will fail to notice Juliet's faults, but he will also be oblivious to the charms of any other woman. At the same time, love is sometimes characterized as a sharpened clarity of attention. If you want to be loved for yourself, you will naturally hope to be seen for what you are. You should not need embellishments, and your lover's affection should not require illusions to sustain it. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Coral is far more red than her lips red. And yet, by God, I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare. Shakespeare, Sonnet 130. The importance of seeing and being seen in love is attested by the intensity of lovers' mutual gaze. In gazing, as we say, into one another's very soul, the lover's mutual desire is enhanced. They feel naked, not only physically, but in their sense of being exposed and vulnerable to one another. The view that love is unblinkered vision, therefore, naturally leads to the expectation of reciprocity as an essential aspect of love. When manifested in mutual gaze, reciprocated love can produce ecstasy, a word that etymologically means standing outside yourself. But reciprocal attention can also feed doubts and anxiety. Some lovers live in constant fear of disappointing their beloved's expectations. From that point of view, love unrequited might be better off. It has no expectations, and so has nothing to be anxious about. In one of the novels of the German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, a character exclaims, "And if I love you, what business is that of yours?" Indeed, if selflessness is the mark of true love, unrequited love might even claim, however implausibly, to be the best kind. Since it receives nothing in return, its manifestations are not exchanged for any favors. One more consideration weighs on the side of those who think only reciprocated love counts as true love. However realistic the lover's vision may be, it is always fed with an imagination of shared activities and plans. In requited love, such imaginings are both effects and causes of mutual engagement. In unrequited love, on the contrary, they are pure fantasies, related to a time or situation that is destined to remain unreal. If love involves dynamic change in the lovers, unrequited love will not provide it. The question of whether reciprocity is essential to love, then, leaves room for contending intuitions. There is no law to be laid down. But if love is regarded as entailing lucid vision, its kinship with agape may suggest another reason not to insist on reciprocity. Agape is the form of love that requires us to become aware, without judgment, of the common humanity we share with all fellow humans. It might be overwhelming to be loved in return by all fellow humans, not to speak of unrealistic to expect it. In addition, agape requires us to abstract from individual preferences. In erotic love, by contrast, individual differences matter supremely. Although these intuitions seem to conflict, they may be reconcilable. Juliet needn't be unaware of Romeo's faults. It is enough that she not regard them as faults. Rightly understood, then, the blindness of love may be a matter not of failing sight, but of failing judgment. Alternatively, love's blindness may be due to deception. "Take a look at the lovers," wrote the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. "No sooner acquainted, how quickly they lie." A young woman once boasted that she never lied to her lovers. When challenged, she clarified, "I only lie to my husband because I love him. I never lie to my lovers." Perhaps she was wise. Only with the most beloved are the stakes likely to be too high to tell the truth. Lies are told for many reasons, but most, perhaps, are intended to spare a loved one's suffering. Self-deception plays its part as well, as illustrated in Shakespeare's Sonnet 138. "When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies." Lovers' expectations are often unreasonable. Only lies and self-deception can protect those whose expectations are radically unreasonable. So, perhaps, there is no great puzzle here after all. Is love freedom or bondage? Many themes are shared between erotic and religious poetry, notably the celebration of freedom gained by surrender. John Donne exploits this paradox in addressing both his lover and his God. In his best-known erotic poem, he writes, "To enter in these bonds is to be free." He expresses the same thought in one of his most exalted religious poems. "Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free." The word enthrall is here intended not in its feeble modern sense of getting me very interested, but in its original sense of enslaved. But how can being enslaved set you free? If you are free, then no one else makes your decisions for you. Your will is free, providing that what determines it comes from inside you, not from some outside force or will. You are free when you do what you want. The catch is that you cannot just decide what to want. You cannot just want at will something you find unattractive any more than you can decide to believe a plain falsehood. Ultimately, your preferences and desires originate in your genes and your upbringing. You had no control over the first and little say about the second. Your desires are your own now, whatever their provenance. Similarly, if you wholeheartedly endorse another's desires, they are now yours, and you may feel relief from the burden of choice. Your enthralled state will feel like the highest freedom. If you are happy in thrall, what is in it for your lover? Lovers want many things: trust, intimacy, emotional resonance, companionship, concern with one another's welfare. Those qualities are desirable in all species of affection and friendship. But erotic love involves two other powerful desires: consummation and perpetuation. The problem is that these two desires are liable to conflict. The reason is that a consummation is an ending. Here, the obsessive project of so much art, to fix the evanescent moment of love forever, as in Shakespeare's Sonnet 65, O fearful meditation, where, alack, shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back? Or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? Oh, none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. What counts as consummation, of course, is different in sex and love, but perhaps not different enough. In sex, consummation is orgasm, but in love, it is often assumed to be marriage, regarded as a form of possession. And to consummate a marriage is to seal possession by sexual intercourse. Non-consummation, in most jurisdictions, is grounds for annulment. Yet possession seems incompatible with the idea that the object of one's love is a subject freely giving their own love. Possession is the relation of master to slave, and as the philosopher Hegel famously pointed out, in a rare moment of lucidity, there is a sense in which slavery curtails not only the slave's freedom, but the master's power as well. For in order to fully enjoy the slave's recognition of his superiority, the master must see that tribute as being freely bestowed. If the slave's submission is forced, it is worthless. Thus, in the full sense in which one might want to possess another human being, even a slave cannot be possessed. That is all the more obviously true in love. If love is not freely given, it can hardly count as love. With possession comes the fear of loss and the urge to defend one's property. What is property? If you own something, you have the right to enjoy it. But we enjoy many things without owning them. The sun, the sea, the beauties of nature. The mark of possession is not enjoyment, but the right to exclude. Jealousy is the emotional guardian of that right of exclusion. Many people regard it as innate, and as we shall hear in Chapter 6, evolutionary psychology provides a standard story about how it works. But insofar as we are concerned with the impact of jealousy on love, as opposed to the enforcement of obligations grounded in a formal or informal contract, jealousy is often strikingly counterproductive. It is frequently manifested in groundless suspicion, ill temper, intrusive surveillance, and sometimes outright violence. Many find such behavior reason enough to fall out of love. Would you not prefer that your lover delight in your company rather than being tormented by fear and loathing at the thought of your enjoying the company of another? Of the two marks of love, pleasure in the beloved or pain over the beloved's other pleasures, surely the former is more likely to retain the beloved's affection. Yet jealousy is often approved of as natural and morally right. Your lover's jealousy can be experienced as a thrilling proof of your own desirability. In illustration of this, someone who worked in a Scottish women's prison related that when she heard inmates talking about the love of their men, it transpired that the criterion appealed to was that a man loves you only if he beats you. If her man did not beat her, the prisoners agreed. That showed he didn't care. Sophisticated sadomasochistic games explore the outer reaches of emotions of trust and vulnerability, and they have a good claim to constitute expressions of a certain sort of love. But it is unlikely that the Scottish prisoners were alluding to such practices. One might dimly imagine that a history of brutal treatment by parental figures might have created an association between attachment and ill-treatment. In such cases, ill-treatment can, unfortunately, come to signal attachment. Whatever the Scottish prisoners had in mind, their opinion is not altogether foreign to popular culture. witness a song entitled "He Hit Me," sung by the 1960s group The Crystals, which carries much the same message. Even where violence is deplored, jealousy is too often regarded as a sufficient excuse for the bad behavior that it motivates. Such attitudes stem from the assumption that the aggressive emotions spurred by jealousy are irresistible and ineluctably part of the very nature of love. Perhaps, however, they have at least as much to do with a certain ideology which endorses an identification of love with possession. Does love mar the purity of sex? If love that is not freely given is not truly love, then love granted in exchange for some other benefit is a perversion of love. Love that is offered merely as a means to gain sex, for example, is frequently disqualified altogether. What is less often noticed is that the converse is also true. It is widely held that sex is best when motivated by love. But motivated how? Phaedrus, a character figuring in a Platonic dialogue that bears his name, was the first, but not the last, to suggest that for the best sex, you are better off avoiding anyone who is in love with you. Consort instead with friends with benefits. Lovers' reciprocal demands are rarely in perfect sync, and when they are not, a lover can be a nuisance. But a more subtle reason is that you don't want to be enjoyed or desired for a reason, whether in sex or in the excitement of intimate conversation, even if that reason is that the other loves you. Love is an ulterior motive in relation to the sex. In the throes of limerence, intense sexual desire is usually taken for granted. But other forms of love, which may be even more prized, motivate people to do all sorts of unpleasant things. If you are sick and disgusting, I may willingly take care of you because I love you. But that's not because I find taking care of someone sick and disgusting intrinsically enjoyable. That thought may spark suspicion if I have sex with you because I love you. In sex, as in love, we might then be tempted to conclude, any reason is the wrong reason. The common dogma that love is purest when not contaminated by sex has an equally plausible converse. We can be sure that sexual desire is pure only when it remains uncontaminated by love. In desire, as in love, freedom requires purity of focus. Just as you might fear that someone who loves you for the sake of sex does not really love you, so you might suspect that someone who has sex out of love, without being limerent, does not really desire you. Given the puzzles and paradoxes that lurk about the concept of love, no single approach will suffice to make sense of it. We need to look at it from many sides. There are as many ways of approaching it as there are models and analogies in terms of which it can be described. Later on, I will survey some of the most recent theories, drawn from evolutionary theory, psychology, sociology, or neuroscience, and ask what we can learn from them. But first, for a fine example of eclecticism in the theory of love, I will turn to the wonderful combination of silliness and profundity in a classic text of antiquity, Plato's seminal Symposium.